Support for WPR comes from Viterbo University. Offering 1 to 2 year master's degree programs in business administration, healthcare leadership, and servant leadership. Viterbo.edu/graduate.
Support for WPR comes from Wills on behalf of Wisconsin Public Libraries, offering access to ebooks, audiobooks, digital magazines, and more. Available with a Wisconsin Library Card at wisconsinsdigitallibrary.org.
Republican state lawmakers proposed a bill that would help Wisconsinites with pre-existing conditions get insurance. Governor Tony Evers, though, is considering vetoing the bill if it reaches his desk. He says the proposal doesn't do enough. We're examining the bill and the politics surrounding it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Do you have a pre-existing medical condition? How has it impacted your ability to get insured? And what would you like lawmakers to know about your situation? 800-642-1234 is the number as we talk about legislation in the works here in Wisconsin. Susan Jaimo is professor of political science and biomedical sciences at Marquette University. Her areas of expertise include public policy and healthcare politics. She's author of Reforming Healthcare in the United States, Germany, and South Africa, Comparative Perspectives on Health. Susan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Walk us through, help us with the specifics of how the proposed bill by Republicans in the state legislature will protect pre-existing conditions.
Well, it would basically say that insurers could not exclude pre-existing conditions from coverage, nor could they charge higher premiums for these kinds of conditions.
And does it go further than that?
It's not as strong as the current protections under the Affordable Care Act, because the Affordable Care Act says that insurers also cannot impose financial, annual, or lifetime caps on coverage, and this bill does not do that. So that could really be a concern for someone who has a very costly illness like cancer, where they're getting a lot of treatment, and they could run up against their cap. And they're also, the bill does not require insurers to offer some of the essential benefits package in the Affordable Care Act, such as hospitalization coverage, prescription drug coverage, and mental health coverage. So it weakens those aspects of the existing protections for consumers and leaves people vulnerable. And the other thing is it doesn't apply to, this is just a federal law that says states can only regulate private insurance, but a federal law, a separate federal law, says that if larger firms self-fund their own health plans, basically set aside their own money to provide health care benefits for their employees, that is not considered insurance. That is not subject to state regulation. So those kinds of larger firms that self-fund would not come under this law at all.
Going back to caps for a moment, do caps exist to essentially save insurance providers money?
Yes. The idea is if they have a really high-cost patient, they can basically say, okay, you've maxed out your coverage. And so this is really a common problem of underinsurance. Someone may think they're insured and they have coverage, but then they find out if they're really sick, say have multiple heart attacks or cancer and such, that they max out their coverage and then they're dropped. And then they have to pay the extra amounts over and above that. So this can be a real cause of medical bankruptcy for certain people who tend to be sicker.
You also mentioned the bill doesn't require insurance plans to contain the same benefits like hospitalization, prescription drug coverage, and medical health care. Those seems like big things, hospitalization and prescription drugs, mental health. These are pretty big components of health insurance.
Yeah, basically what this is doing is sort of mimicking what the Trump administration did, which allows for these kinds of skimpy plans to be offered off of healthcare.gov, the health insurance marketplace, and this would basically be the same kind of thing here in Wisconsin, but it would allow this for individual coverage or firms. So it's not as good of coverage as the Affordable Care Act, but the idea is it would come with a lower premium. Okay, so you would save on the premium, but you might have you might be really exposed when you really need care. So these kinds of plans work well if an individual or a firm is trying to manage their costs, but it does so at the expense of leaving people very vulnerable financially for things, the kinds of basic necessary health care they would need.
Are these skimpy plans popular? How are they doing on the marketplace? What do we know about these plans?
Well, they only started this year, so starting in 2019, so it's really hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically, they were intended, these so-called skimpy plans were basically initially kind of short-term plans for people just to tide them over between jobs and to have some kind of catastrophic coverage so that if you ended up in the hospital, you wouldn't go bankrupt. But they never had the same kind of breadth of and depth of coverage provision or benefit protections that the Affordable Care Act did. So that's why they were cheaper. And so they tended to appeal for people who are just going in between short-term gaps in insurance coverage, say between one job to the next, or if they were young and healthy and kind of assumed that they wouldn't get sick. But, you never know when you're going to get sick. So there's always an uncertainty in healthcare, and to allow firms or individuals to buy these kinds of plans long-term can be pretty risky.
So high-risk plan for the individual because you never know when a disaster may strike.
Yeah, and for small firms, if they want to offer these kinds of plans because they would not be subject to the same kinds of benefit requirements of the current Affordable Care Act. So it would save firms money, too. They would offer less comprehensive coverage to their employees.
Susan Gimo is with us. She is a Marquette political scientist and a health policy expert. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Would you like the state to pass a bill like this, since the ACA is being challenged in court? Would you like the government to be less involved in health care? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Paul from Eau Claire has emailed and is wondering, I'm one of the younger, healthier people with no pre-existing conditions. Why should I be expected to pay for the sick and the elderly? It seems taken for granted in the discussion.
That's a good question, and that's one of the arguments for allowing people to take less comprehensive coverage. The whole idea is that if these kinds of plans are available to younger and healthier people, then it really leaves older and sicker people facing higher premiums across the board for their coverage. And so it's this whole idea of pooling risks. So if you start offering these kinds of plans to people that have limited coverage, it's going to draw away younger, healthier people and destroy risk pooling, which is essential to insurance. I mean, insurers understand this, and this has nothing to do with politics or ideology. If you don't have enough healthy people in the insurance pool, then the remaining people who are there are going to be sicker, use more health care, and the premiums are going to keep rising for everyone until they stop buying insurance or the insurers go bankrupt. So part of it is the mechanism of how insurance works. And the second part of it is that you may be young and healthy now, but eventually you're going to be older and sicker, or you might end up having a child or a spouse who has a medical condition. And I think then your calculations might change.
We're talking with Marquette University political scientist Susan Gimo about a new health care bill in Wisconsin. The Assembly Health Committee plans to vote on the bill today. It's designed to provide cover if Affordable Care Act protections were to dissolve. Your thoughts on this at 800-642-1234. We'll get back to the conversation in just a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On the national level, Democrats campaigned heavily on health care in the last election cycle, particularly protecting people with pre-existing medical conditions. And now that lawsuit threatens to kill the entire Affordable Care Act, and most Republicans aren't trying to stop it, and some openly want it to succeed. Now, here at home in Wisconsin, there's new legislation led by Republicans to shield people with pre-existing conditions if the ACA is not upheld. And Governor Tony Evers doesn't think it goes far enough. What do you think? How does the politics surrounding healthcare legislation make you feel? What do you think needs to be done to get Americans on the same page? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Susan Gimo is our guide. She is a political science and biomedical sciences professor at Marquette. Her areas of expertise include public policy and healthcare politics. Susan, in healthcare news this week is that Governor Evers says he plans to stick to his campaign promise of expanding health insurance in Wisconsin under the ACA, meaning the federal government would cover more insurance costs for the state. Is this contingent on the survival of the Affordable Care Act in court?
Well, yes, in order to get that kind of federal money. States have always been able to expand or narrow the number of people eligible for Medicaid before the Affordable Care Act, and they had the federal government would pay a certain percentage of a state's Medicaid costs. But under the Affordable Care Act, the Medicaid expansion covers people up to the 138% of the poverty line, which is about $16,000 for an individual annual income. They would get coverage under a state's Medicaid program, as would adults and low-income individuals even without dependents or children. They would get coverage under the Medicaid program, and the federal government would pay 100% of the additional cost of covering these people for up to 3 years, and then after 3 years, by 2020, essentially, because this has been going on for a few years, the federal share would be 90%. As opposed to what it is currently in Wisconsin, which is about 55%.
So can we have a bill here in Wisconsin to, in a sense, protect some of the pre-existing conditions and then also have the ACA and Wisconsin have more of a buy-in to that at the same time? I mean, does the legislation start to collide with each other?
Well, no, I just think both of the Medicaid expansion is hinging on the Affordable Care Act being upheld as constitutional, and this is tied up in the courts right now. So currently the Affordable Care Act is still in place, but it's going to take some time as it wends its way through the court system to decide whether the law is constitutional or not. If it is declared unconstitutional by higher courts, maybe even the Supreme Court, then all the subsidized insurance and the Medicaid expansion and all the consumer protections in terms of basic benefits and protection against pre-existing conditions goes out the window. So then the state could not tap into the Medicaid expansion fund.
Mm-hmm.
But then a law that would protect people against pre-existing conditions would be important. The problem is the pre-existing conditions law bill in the legislature right now does not go as far as the current consumer protections under the Affordable Care Act. So I think you could think of the pre-existing conditions provision as sort of a plan B or a safety net in case the Affordable Care Act is declared unconstitutional.
And so
Medicaid expansion is something requiring the Affordable Care Act to still be around.
Governor Evers said this week that the state bill must be equal to or better than what exists at the federal level under the ACA, in a sense meaning he may veto this bill. How might that look after he ran a campaign on protecting health care for Wisconsinites?
Yeah, I think he might have to, he would have to justify that to people to somehow. The one thing he could say, I think, is that it's not good enough, but on the other hand, if there are enough Democrats who were to go along with it in the Senate, and the Republicans have a narrow majority, but if enough Democrats come on board, they could pass it. They could say, hey, this is at least better than nothing in case the Affordable Care Act is declared unconstitutional. We want to make sure people have coverage. Or there could be amendments to the bill if the Republicans are willing, but they don't seem to be, that you have to have the identical language in terms of consumer protections for pre-existing conditions, minimum benefits, and maybe something like the states putting in money for reinsurance to private insurers who have very, very high-cost patients. So once a patient reaches a certain dollar amount for the insurance company to cover, then some sort of state pool or something would kick in and fund those high-cost claims. So there are already these kinds of provisions around in the Affordable Care Act for people who buy healthcare.gov on the exchange, and they're very, very high-cost patients, and there's a reinsurance fund.
We are talking with Susan Gimo. She's a political scientist and health policy expert. And we're talking about legislation here in Wisconsin that would look to provide more coverage for people with pre-existing conditions if the ACA is not upheld. You can join in the conversation. Are you watching this legislation? Do you have pre-existing conditions? Would you like the state to pass a bill like this since the ACA is being challenged in federal court? Would you like the government to be less involved in healthcare, perhaps? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Susan, a number of campaigns in Wisconsin and across the nation in the last election, there were campaign promises on protecting pre-existing condition. It's a claim Democrats said, though, for Republicans was hypocritical given the lawsuit against the ACA and the repeal efforts. Is this bill that Wisconsin Republicans are producing here keeping their promise to voters?
Well, no, because partly yes and no, I guess, would be the way to say it. Yes, they're protecting some minimum level of pre-existing conditions for people, but that, again, does not apply to the firms that are not regulated by state law who self-fund, and that covers maybe half the workforce. Now, most of those larger firms already cover pre-existing conditions, so the assumption is that probably wouldn't be an issue. But the other thing about having plans offer less comprehensive benefits and not cover things like mental health or hospitalization or prescription drugs, that would seem to be a betrayal of the campaign promises of the Republicans.
Republicans have said that they have no interest in replicating the ACA. And so with a divided government, what do you think the chances are of passing state legislation that includes the same protections mirroring the Affordable Care Act? Is it possible?
Probably in the current climate, no, because we have divided government and two parties who are pretty polarized. If there's an ability for moderates in both parties to come around some kind of compromise, then you might have something like this current pre-existing conditions bill passing the legislature, and Evers might sign it and say, well, this is the best we can do right now. We're going to come in and fix it later after 2020 if we get a larger majority, say, in the Senate or something like that, or if we're able to retake the Senate. But it is very difficult. So I think what has to happen is you have compromise that doesn't please everybody in this era of polarization, or there's just the two sides kind of dig in and nothing gets passed.
Yeah, because
people who favor the Affordable Care Act hope that it is upheld as constitutional, and then you wouldn't need this pre-existing conditions bill.
And Assembly Republicans passed a similar bill last year, but it failed in the Senate. Is this bill headed for a similar situation here, or do you see some inroads with lawmakers coming to a consensus?
Well, the Senate, the Republicans have, it failed by one vote last time in the last session, but the Republicans have a slightly stronger edge in terms of their majority. It's 19-14. So if they were able to keep this bill in place and corral enough of their own senators, they could pass it. And if you had a couple of one or two Democrats, there could be some measure of bipartisan support. So it's hard to say. I know that Senator Lena Taylor was considering supporting the bill. She's a Democrat. So it may, the chances of it passing might be a little bit better, and then the question is whether Governor Evers will sign it or not.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Happy to be here.
Susan Gyimow is a professor of political science and biomedical sciences at Marquette University, and her areas of expertise include public policy and healthcare politics. Up next, it's the news. Then, is it okay to share information and photos of your kids on social media? We're talking about the intersection of families, technology use, and privacy. What do you think about it? Do you share about your kids on social media? 800-642-1234. You can join in the conversation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Many parents post photos and videos of their precious child on social media because they're proud of their families and they want to stay connected with relatives and friends. But when does it cross the line? Question we're considering now in The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Some Instagram stars have made it a lucrative business. We might hear this new term, sharenting, tossed around. It's used to describe the overuse of social media by parents to share content based on their children. It's related to the concept of TMI. So is it wrong to mix kids and social media? When do you think these posts and pics cross a line? And what about privacy? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Priya Kumar is a doctoral candidate at the University of Maryland's College of Information Studies. Her research focuses on the intersection of families, technology use, and privacy. Priya, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
So where do you come down on this? Is it okay for parents to post about their kids on social media?
So I get this question all the time, and I would say it depends on how the parent feels about it at the end of the day. I think it's really important to sort of think about what's new in this practice and what's not new. And this idea that, you know, parents are taking pictures of their family, of their kids, they're sharing them with others. That's something that families have done since cameras have been around. You know, people have been recording their details of everyday life since we've had diaries, which has been for centuries. So I think this desire to sort of want to share your family with others is age old. And social media is where we do it now. So parents who do that, I think it's fine. There are parents who would choose not to, and I do think that's fine also. For me, the most important thing is that parents think about what they, you know, want to be doing. Is this something they want to be doing? How do they want to be doing social media? And then communicating that with others.
But how do you set up some certain boundaries? I mean, it's always nice to have a quota or a threshold when you set up these parameters for yourself.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And so that's where I think, is, you know, for people who are expecting a child, you know, before they've created this digital footprint for a child, thinking what, you know, what sort of a social media footprint do they want to have? And even for parents who already have children, you know, thinking about first, what is your social media use? What role does social media play in your life? You know, if it's a benefit for you, if you get a lot of joy and satisfaction out of being able to share with people, then that's great. And you probably will get that you'll probably continue doing that by sharing information about your kids. But if you find sort of social media to be stressful or feel pressure, then, you know, maybe it's not playing a good role in your life. So I think that's a good starting point. But then also, especially for people whose kids are a little bit older, you know, talking to your kids about this question, I think is really important. So even as young as sort of around ages 4 to 6, children are developing a sense of self. So even for children that young, I would say parents can talk to their kids and ask them, how do they feel about it? Sort of explain them on a rudimentary level what social media is and what they think about having their pictures on there. And then, of course, continuing those conversations or definitely having them with older children. I think obviously it's a little more difficult when you have a newborn because you are kind of the one making the decision. But I would say sort of step back and think about the role that social media plays in your life and then reflect that sort of in your use of social media around information about your kids.
So where might this go off rail here? What are some potential consequences for children of having photos or information about them posted online, no matter how cute they are or positive?
Yeah, that's a good question. And sort of, so for as long as I've been studying this topic, I've thought about it from this perspective of, you know, today's children are inheriting this digital footprint, whereas for a lot of us, we sort of got to create our own. And I think one of the biggest fears does come down to sort of the privacy question of, are children going to grow up and then one day think, oh, all of these people sort of saw me grow up, or they saw these, all of these mundane details about their life. And I think that's one of the questions that really animates this debate. There are also questions around, you know, where could this content go? And that's where, you know, I think it's helpful to think about, how has this practice changed? So I talked a little bit earlier about how this desire to, you know, document our children's childhood is nothing new, but of course the way that we do it is. And so yes, the design of the technologies that we use does mean that when parents post these pictures online, they can, it's more easy for them to spread in terms of going viral in ways that are unexpected. The audience for these types of pictures is much broader, and it's persistent. So people can go and scroll back through and sort of look at pictures that somebody posted years ago. And I think that's where the privacy concerns come up. But, you know, again, this is something that all of us are dealing with. I mean, a lot of us are on social media, whether we use it or whether other people have posted pictures of us. So I think this is something that's definitely, you know, facing the new generation. But then again, the world is always different for our children than it was for us and than it was for our parents. So they will figure out how to navigate this.
In the end, we're talking with Priya Kumar. She is a PhD candidate at the University of Maryland's College of Information Studies. And you can join in this conversation. What is your policy on posting photos or information about your kids on social media? Do you think tech companies should have more stringent policies in place to protect children's information on social media? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Priya, if you go on Instagram, it's hard not to come across a cute baby or a toddler in a swimming pool or something, but some Instagram stars are also making money off of these photos. How does that work?
Sure. So I think that's part of sort of the broader phenomenon around this idea of making a living off of being an influencer. There are, moms who blogged, sort of colloquially called mommy bloggers, have been doing this for at least a decade, if not longer, this idea of sort of writing about your life and then and making money off of that. I mean, children themselves have been making money. And if you think about child actors, they've been around for about a century. So again, aspects of the sort of Instagram child star aren't new, but of course some of them are, in that it's a lot easier for somebody to sort of start doing that. I think there is definitely a difference between the sort of everyday, you know, a parent posting a cute picture occasionally or just sort of on their own Facebook profile, then families or parents using social media to generate income. I think those are two different practices. And certainly aspects of, there are sort of ethical or other questions that come up for sort of the idea of making money off of a child's likeness or sort of life. But I think it is also important to remember that itself isn't completely new.
Let's go to Aaron now in Oshkosh. Aaron, what are your thoughts on this?
Hi, I was wondering about the identity theft implications of posting your child on social media growing up and things like that.
So you mean, could someone steal a child's identity based on what you're posting?
Exactly, their photos. I've heard things about fingerprints and photos where people are waving. Is that a real threat to your child?
Priya, what do we know here?
So that's a great question. I don't know about that specific question about fingerprints. I do know child identity theft is actually a, it can happen. The Federal Trade Commission does have some resources around protecting it or protecting against it. And I think that's where it comes down to sort of don't post, never post a child's social security number for sure. Try not to post sort of their birth date, although I know that when people post birth announcements that, you know, inevitably ends up happening. But I think this is where drawing some sort of common sense boundaries for yourself around the types of information you will and won't share comes in handy. And I think it can be helpful to remember sort of what would you do if you wanted to protect yourself from identity theft? Similar things. So not posting sort of details like your social security number, your birth date, your location, the location of your child's school or daycare, things like that. Not posting any sort of financial information. Creating a Google alert for your child's name could be one way to sort of make sure you have, you know, if anyone else is talking about your child. If you're really concerned about pictures, some parents have decided that they won't post pictures of a child's face, for example. So you can post pictures of the child from behind, you know, pictures of the child holding something or their feet in the sand, something like that, to avoid sort of their face being in there. So I think, you know, thinking about the types of information you might be revealing when you post is important, but I think that there are ways to share without sort of revealing that type of personal information.
Erin, may I ask, when you post or do you think about this type of thing when you do post to social media with a child's image or information?
So I actually don't have children yet, but we're talking about having them. And I have friends that don't show their child's face in photos, and I have parents that are sort of in that TMI category and post everything about their child. And so we're just starting to think about what plan should we take on social media for our child.
And so you kind of are figuring out where are you on that spectrum, and it sounds like, Priya, this is a spectrum.
It is, and I think that's great, Erin, that you're thinking about it now. One thing that I think is also important is, you know, of course, if you have a partner or something, talking about this with your partner so that you are on the same page, and then also making sure to communicate your preferences to other people can be really important. So whatever you decide to do, just tell, you know, communicating with the grandparents or family or close friends to let them know, hey, are you posting or not posting? If you are going to post pictures, where? A lot of people will choose to do it on a different site, you know, not Facebook or something like that. And then do you care if other people post pictures of your child? So just think about it, but then, you know, communicate it to other people.
Coordinating a plan. Priya Kumar researches families, technology use, and privacy at the University of Maryland. Parents are questioning the wisdom of posting so much about their kids online. Is sharing pictures online of your child something you should be worrying about? 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show as we talk about posting photos and information about kids on social media. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The London School of Economics published a recent report that found 3/4 of parents who use the internet at least monthly share photos or videos of their children online. And parents are more likely to do this with younger children. A little more than half only share pictures with close family and friends. Where do you come down on this? 800-642-1234. What's your policy on posting photos or information about your kids on social media? How did you arrive at that decision? And do you ask your kids before posting stories about them online? Priya Kumar is our guide. She researches technology use, privacy, and families at the University of Maryland. Let's go back to the phones now with Kelly joining us from Cascade. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Great topic. I'm a mommy blogger. I have wrestled with this very topic. And I've kind of wrestled, too, with keeping my privacy settings kind of personal to friends and, you know, acquaintances. And sometimes I kind of flip it to spread the information more broadly. I've kind of gone back to the private, for more private settings just because that feels right now. So I feel like that's important to just honor where we're at in the moment. The other thing is, as my girls are getting older, I've really been mindful of including them in conversation about, you know, here's what I'm thinking of posting. Are you okay with this? They know that it's totally okay for them to say, Mommy, please don't post that. And I want to honor their, you know, their feelings, and I don't want them to be embarrassed by anything. I'm also very careful that if I do post information that's kind of more personal, I share from my perspective about my experience as a mother versus information that might come back to haunt them someday or embarrass them in some way.
Kelly bringing forth a number of points here, Priya. Also moving her privacy settings around based on where she's at in the information. That's really interesting.
Yeah, Kelly, everything you said, I definitely agree with. It sounds, I mean, this idea of thinking about it, talking to your kids, I think all that is really, really important. But you definitely raise a really good point around privacy settings. And yes, obviously, this stuff changes over time. You might be fine posting publicly at some point in time and then at a different point in time change your mind. And so, yes, it is important to think about every so often what your privacy settings are and make them fit sort of what you want to be doing. But I think this is a great point to sort of show that this is a broader problem than just, you know, how us as individual parents decide what to do. And this idea of wrestling with it, going back to sort of the way that a lot of these platforms that we use are designed. And so, you know, we live in a world where a lot of the places where we go to share information about ourselves, whether it's social media or whether it's blogging online, are dominated by companies that essentially use surveillance as their business model. So we live in a world where sort of companies are extracting data from us and using it in ways that we don't know. And I think that is the sort of when we talk about privacy, that's the bigger problem here. And that, of course, is much larger than just the question of posting pictures of children. But it's a question we're thinking about as that logic starts to extend into other industries, this idea of sort of data-driven decision-making. So yes, the fact that you're wrestling with it, I think, is emblematic of the fact that we as a society are wrestling with these same types of questions, even when it comes to other types of data or material.
Let's bring in Ben from Wanakee into the conversation. Ben, where are you on this?
Yeah, good morning. I just have a question, comment. You know, social media typically portrays the beautiful side of life, the perfect side of life, and so it is also with posts that include our children. As these children grow up and possibly become adults themselves and only see the side of perfection, what effects does that have as far as maybe fostering a culture of perfectionism?
Priya?
Ben, that's a great question. I think it gets to also this idea that, you know, in our cultural moment, there's this idea of sort of intensive parenting and that we have to devote our entire lives towards, you know, investing in our children so that they turn out perfect and then making sure that everyone sees that that is effortless. I mean, I think that's very much sort of the way we approach parenting now, and that is definitely problematic. But I think, how do we help sort of our kids realize that that's not reality? And that, I think, comes back to sort of that communication between parents and kids. So if you are taking a picture and posting it, showing your child like, oh yeah, I took 6 pictures of you just now, but which one should I post? You know, I'm going to post the best one because a lot of people are going to see it. But making sure that they recognize that what goes on Facebook or what gets sent out in the sort of holiday Christmas card is very intentionally the best picture, and that but life itself isn't always the best picture, and that when you look at other people's pictures, you don't necessarily know what's going on. So I agree. I think it's a broader problem around sort of this culture that we have around parenting. But I think the way that we can address that sort of with our own kids is just talking with them about it. Like, what is social media? What does it reflect? And making sure they know it doesn't reflect everyday life. It definitely reflects the version of life that we want to portray to others, which we do because the audience on social media is so broad.
So as we look at this data and this information and all of these images out there, I mean, just in billions, perhaps, I don't even know how many. Where do we go with tech companies on privacy? We saw in France, grown children can sue their parents for posting photos of them online. Do you think there should be laws in place to protect children's privacy?
So I definitely think that there is a place for a broad privacy protection for all of us, not just for children. I mean, we do in this country have the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, but that law doesn't actually sort of protect children's privacy from their parents posting information about them online, because it's the parents that are posting. But I think, you know, privacy protection, a baseline privacy protection for all of us would, I think, go a long way towards addressing some of the big privacy questions that we have. I mean, the European Union has had data protection law in place since 1995, and then last year's GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, made it stronger. But we in the US we have privacy laws for specific types of information, but we don't have this kind of a baseline privacy law. So I think having that kind of law would help all of us. When it comes to the individual question of, you know, if a child grows up and feels very embarrassed about what their parents posted or does feel like their parents invaded their privacy, I don't think a law is going to address that problem. I think at the end of the day, it goes back to that kind of communication. So while your children are younger, sort of having those open lines of communication so that they understand why their pictures are on the internet. And then most important, if a child ever opposes this or says to a parent, I don't want you to post anything of me, I think it's really important to honor their decision, to respect their decision, and to give them some say over how they are being represented online. And so hopefully that type of communication can forestall any potential concerns.
Priya, as we wrap up here, is there a low-tech way to perhaps approach this, share, feel good about sharing, but that doesn't have such high stakes as social media?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think there's always email, good old-fashioned email. There's getting your pictures printed and dropping them in the mail. I know some parents that I've interviewed will create a physical baby book. They'll print out pictures and then they'll mail that to the grandparents. I think the problem is a lot of the low-tech approaches are time-consuming, and that's part of the draw. You know, social media is so convenient. But I think, you know, going back to sort of being a little more intentional, making sure that you have the physical copy might be good for some people. And that is sort of a good reminder, always back up your pictures. A lot of people use social media as their sort of modern day baby book or as their photo album, but you don't want those pictures to disappear. So it's good to have the analog photos no matter what.
Priya, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Priya Kumar is a PhD candidate at the University of Maryland's College of Information Studies, and her research focuses on the intersection of families, technology use, and privacy. Just ahead, by some measures, the U.S. economy is humming along. We look at the American worker, though, in crisis. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're with us on the Ideas Network.